Welcome to this special bonus audio interview that accompanies Steve McKnight's latest book, From Naught to 260 Plus Properties in 7 Years. I'm Michael Schulberger. The aim of this program is to provide you with detailed information about how you can fine-tune your investing strategies to ensure they remain relevant in a rapidly changing real estate market. I'm joined by best-selling author and professional investor Steve McKnight. I'll be asking Steve to provide more information about several of the topics he's written about in his latest book, From Naught to 260 Plus Properties in 7 Years. Steve, welcome.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be here, and thanks for the opportunity to have a chat about real estate and what's happening in the market at the moment.
And you approach it all quite differently from others, so we'll go into that. Now, assuming that the listeners don't know much about you or your background, what experience do you have and why are you considered an authority on property investing?
I'm probably a little bit different to what most people might come across because I have a blend of academic knowledge and also property investing experience of a magnitude that really not many people aspire to, I guess. As far as the academic side of things, I'm a qualified chartered accountant. I've spent my time in what I regard as the salt mine, which was working for one of the large international accounting practices, working in audit. Rapidly promoted on the basis of doing silly things like working 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, in addition to studying. So I guess I managed to get ahead in that regard. Learned a lot, worked in very many different theatres of business. One week I was watching cars whiz around the assembly line. The next I was out auditing duty-free stores. And then another week again I was doing costing on jet fighter planes. And so you just get amazing experience. But I soon realised that I didn't want to follow the general career progression that most accountants working in public practice do, which is become a manager, become a partner. In my first book, I think I described it this way. I looked up the corporate ladder and all I could see was the butt of the guy in front of me, and I didn't like the view, so I decided to hop off the ladder altogether. What I decided to do was really start up my own accounting practice on the basis that I could work fewer hours and earn the same amount of pay that I was getting working as a chartered accountant. But even after just a few months of doing that, I realized that there had to be another way of making money other than selling my time. And I started buying little cheap houses in the country. It was May 1999, and the first house I bought was about $44,000. I had a business partner at the time, a gentleman by the name of David Bradley, and together we teamed up and bought well over 260, probably closer to 300 properties over the last seven or so years. And if you average that out, it's a ridiculous, you know, a new property every 9 or so days. And this isn't some extravagant, overinflated figure. This is using our own money, not someone else's money, on the basis of doing an 80% lend. So we would use 20% of our own deposit money. And when we consider that we started with really not much in the bank and a new business that lenders didn't like lending to, it's really quite a phenomenal achievement. Not that I'm trying to pat myself on the back, but just saying to people, look, when you have a big vision and you work really hard, you can still actually get a good result.
So you bought cheap properties, but how did you make money out of them?
Most people buy real estate, and when they buy real estate, they try and make money out of capital gains. It's tried and tested. I buy something, it goes up in value, and potentially a lot of people never sell because then they have to pay tax. The approach that I took to the whole real estate investing was, if I bought a property that made a cash flow return, even if it was a small amount, then all I had to do was own a lot of real estate that would then generate a lot of income. And so 260 plus properties, we never actually owned 260 at one time. We might have owned 80 or 90 or 100 properties at one time. But 100 properties, say, at $20 a week times 52 weeks, all of a sudden becomes enough money to not have to do accounting anymore. And again, I think I'm different to perhaps some people in the wealth creation industry that talk about a nice home and a beautiful boat and a Ferrari. I'm not into that. I think the trappings of wealth are very overstated. I like to have control of my time. And what I value in my own moral world is being able to be there, take my daughter swimming, spend time with my wife. Like, these are the things that I value. So rather than trying to have $50 million in the bank and a $50 million lifestyle, all I wanted to have was, say, an income stream of around $200,000 per annum, pay tax out of that, but then buy my life back. So you don't actually need to own 260 properties to be a success as such, but what you need to have is some kind of system that generates an income stream that you can then use to fund your lifestyle so you don't need to work in a job.
But to be cash flow positive, you have to have better rental than what you're paying in interest, which means, presumably, that you have to put in a substantial deposit.
Yeah, normally for the, perhaps the standard types of properties that people buy, but the ones that I was targeting at $44,000, the rental was $125 a week. And when you take off the loan repayments and you take off all the expenses, you're still left with the residual amount that you can bank and live off, which is what we did.
So how many properties realistically do you need to then be able to make some money?
It sounds perhaps a bit cliche, but I say to people, you're only one deal away from actually achieving financial independence if you can find that one deal and apply it over and over and over again. I know people who have five properties, but the way that they've structured their affairs, those five properties are debt-free because they've been doing property transactions to make them debt-free. And five properties at $400 a week rent is $2,000. $2,000 times 52 weeks is enough for them to live off. So you don't actually need a massive property portfolio, but you need a system that works that allows you to facilitate the outcome that you're after.
So you're not really looking at the capital gain benefit?
Well, not when I started. More so today, I've changed my thinking a little bit and differentiated between cash properties, where you're trying to make a lump sum cash gain, and cash flow properties, which is less of a profit but over a longer period of time. The market's certainly gone up a lot since I started buying real estate. And to go to Ballarat now and try and find a $44,000 property, you're going to have a hard task at trying to do that. So what we need to do, and what I've done and what everyone needs to do, is evolve their property investing strategy so that it remains relevant to the market. For instance, there's no point going to Collingwood in Melbourne and trying to find a $40,000 property that hasn't existed for 40 years. So the way that we evolve and the new approaches that we bring to the table, perhaps some of the things that we're going to have a chance to talk about today, but also in particular, what I'd say to investors, if you're doing what you did now and still expecting to make the same amount of profit that you made yesterday, then you're probably on the fringe of becoming irrelevant, because we continually need to update and change what we do because the nature of the opportunity in the market changes as well.
What do you say to people who only own one or two properties?
Be careful, because the risk is that they're probably a hobby investor, and a hobby investor is a bit like a hybrid push bike. I actually ride around on a hybrid push bike a fair bit, and a hybrid push bike is one that's not a mountain bike and not a racer, but a combination of the two. Well, a hobby investor is someone who has a full-time job and is trying to get a full-time outcome out of their investing, but only contributing a part-time effort. And they're probably wondering why things aren't clicking, why they can't find these great deals that they read about in the book or they hear other people getting. And it's because really their focus isn't quite right. Their focus is on their work, and they're contributing second-class time to their investing. And because they're contributing second-class time but expecting a first-class outcome, if you like, it's just not gelling. So if you only own one or two properties, my strongest recommendation, if you like, is go back and figure out what you want. Because the outcome you've achieved is no fluke. It's as a result of what you've been contributing to it. And if you want to get a different outcome, they're going to need to do something differently. So for these guys who have one or two properties, they're probably sitting on a fair bit of equity. The danger is that they've got lazy money because they're not using that equity effectively. I would encourage people to really think about what they're doing and to try and find more time for investing. Because if you can't find the time to invest, then you're never really going to get ahead.
Which means it's really very critical as to which property you buy.
Yeah, and certainly don't go out into the market and buy anything or what a real estate agent says is a good investment. No one is going to have a more vested interest in your success than you, and that's why it's important to skill up and to know what makes a good property and what is it about a property that's going to drive the price higher. Because the average person, Michael, goes and buys something and sits on it and waits for it to go up in value. Anecdotally, the property market only goes up for a third of the time. It's either flat or down for two-thirds of the time. And I can't for the life of me figure out why anyone would use a strategy that would only work for a third of the time and fail for two-thirds of the time. Yet that explains why so many people own so few pieces of real estate. Well, the research I've done was 92% of real estate investors, this is Australian Bureau of Statistics information, 92% of real estate investors only own one or two properties. Well, why? If owning real estate makes money, surely you'd want to own more than one or two properties. But then when you look at the system behind the way that people have bought real estate, negative gearing and loading it up to the max as far as their debt goes, they can't actually afford to own any more. Well, that must mean that the investing system is flawed, because you want to own more. You don't want to own less. Like, how can you ever own 260 properties with a system where most people only ever own one or two? You have to crack the model and start again. And that's what I did.
Now, that's all very well, Steve, but how can someone make a start as a property investor in the first place?
This may sound a bit strange, but what I'd say is before anyone goes and buys anything or listens to a real estate agent or jumps on realestate.com.au or any other website where they're trying to find a property, if you look at those words, Michael, real estate investing, a lot of people focus on the word real estate, but I focus on the word investing. I'm an investor trying to maximize my return on my investment, whether it's shares or property or businesses. That's the context. But in the real estate context, to understand investing, investing is all about money flow and money management. So before anyone invests, what I encourage people to do is to work on their money management. Because let's say that you're in a situation where you want to go and buy 20 properties because you don't have a lot of money. You want to go and, I don't know, buy a new car or take your family on a holiday. Well, the real problem you've got is the situation you're in at the moment. And that didn't happen by chance. That happened as a result of the way that you manage money at the moment. So for people who have money problems at the moment, throwing more money at it just makes their problems bigger. It doesn't make their problems go away. That's one of the fallacies of wealth creation is people put out these ads with boats and cars and promise a better lifestyle, but it never eventuates because someone who can't handle a little bit of money has no chance of handling a lot of money. So well before anyone goes and buys any real estate, what I'd say is take a look at the way you're managing your money at the moment. And if you're proving trustworthy with what you've got and you're doing well, that's great. If not, then go back and work on those habits. And this really introduces something I saw on the TV the other night, which was quite funny. It was a guy in the UK who'd won £10 million in the lottery. And they had an image of this guy doing dodgem cars in limousines. He went and bought limousines and was out in his paddock. He had some mansion somewhere and was driving it around and effectively totaling these brand new limousines because he had so much money he didn't know what to do with it. And at the end, what happened is there was just a little grab at the end that said, oh, yeah, now he's just down to his last £500,000. So here's a guy who has squandered so much. Well, while we might look at that and have a laugh and think we would never do it, most people will earn a literal fortune over their lives and squander most of it. And until we make a stand against that and say that's not what we're going to do, that we spend less than we earn, we don't have much chance of being a success in real estate.
Now, this brings us to your yes formula.
Yeah, that's right. I always like to try and teach. I've worked in universities doing lecturing and my grandmother was a teacher, my mother's a teacher, my sister's a teacher. I think there's teaching in the family. I like to try and break down reasonably complicated concepts into nice, easy formulas. So in this case, when it comes to money management, I've devised this thing called YES, which is Y minus E equals S, so yes overall. Let me just explain it a little bit. Y is actually the symbol or the letter that economists attribute to the word income. So if you've got income minus expenses equals savings, then really all wealth creation is as simple as knowing how to apply that formula. That is, spending less than you earn. But people don't think in that context. What they do is they think expense first, income second, savings is a bonus. So what they do is they earn according to their expenses rather than spend according to their income. It's slightly skew-if just to start off with. And because we always spend more than we earn, and statistics in Australia unfortunately say that at the moment Australians really have a negative savings rate. So really what they're doing is they're spending more than they earn and they can't catch up. So the difference if you spend more than you earn is to use debt. And of course Australians are getting in more and more debt. Just look in the headlines each month in the paper. Some stats that I used in the book are credit cards have gone up over 10 years from $2,950 to $7,889 as a limit. Australians currently owe $155 in debt for each $100 they earn. This is crazy, crazy statistics. Like we just can't handle money as a nation, and we're becoming more and more in debt. And because we're becoming more and more in debt, people are more and more interested in wealth creation as a magic way of getting out of it. But as I said, it doesn't work like that. If you have more expenditure than income, then you have to use debt. It's interesting. Like, what do banks lend against when it comes to giving money? People say, well, a house. But they don't. They don't lend against the house. They take the house if you don't pay. They actually lend against your future ability to earn money because that's what's going to repay them. So every time you borrow $1,000, you're taking $1,000 of income you're going to earn in the future and spending it now. So you have to go and earn that $1,000. So unless you ever get on the right side of this Y minus E equals S equation, you're always going to be struggling to get ahead. And that's why the very first thing that any investor needs to do is take a look at how their income and expenditure pattern is netting together. And if it's not working, then to stop and fix it before going and buying any property. So that's the yes formula. Income minus expenses equals savings. If you have more income than expenses, then you'll get savings. If you have more expenses than income, then you'll use savings until the point where you have no more savings left, and then you'll get into debt. What I like to do in my investments and in my own personal money management is always been a situation where I have income greater than expenses, thereby building wealth. More income than expenses builds wealth. It's that simple. You can't work this equation any other way.
What you've just said will ring a lot of bells with a lot of people. What should they do?
Generally speaking, buy income-producing assets. Now, I don't have property to sell. That's not the game that I'm in. I try and educate people about properties that they should buy, try and teach them how to fish rather than giving them a fish, if you like. But what I say to people is that in retirement, and we're all going to get to retirement sooner or later, a position where we no longer work for money. For some of us, it might be later in life. For some of us, it might be earlier in life. Some people have a choice. Some people don't have a choice. But what we want to end up in a situation with is effectively like a golden goose. So we want to try and find a golden goose that's going to lay golden eggs that's going to feed us in retirement. If we don't ever find that golden goose, then unfortunately we're going to be stuck with whatever the government can afford to give us in the way of a pension. Now, some people have no option but to go down that road, and the government ought to provide for its citizens. Like, as a corporate citizen, that's what we need to be doing. But what I'd be saying and what I'm trying hard to do is get into a situation where I buy assets that throw off income over time, because then in retirement I've got all these assets generating all this income, which means that I don't have to rely on the government, therefore I can plot my own future and my own course. So what can people do to get ahead? Well, first of all, start repaying debt, because if you're in debt, don't try and make money to get out of debt. Understand how debt works and understand your requirement to repay it. And as you repay debt, also get into a situation where you start acquiring income-producing assets. Now, that might be a two- or a three-step process, because in order to end up with an income-producing asset, as you said before, you might have to pay down debt. So you might have to get into a couple of what I would regard as property trades, where you get in, you renovate, you make $40,000 or $50,000 on the project, and then the next time round, you use that $40,000 or $50,000 to repay debt and thereby create a positive cash flow outcome. An example, Michael, that I see a lot of people doing at the moment is that they buy a house on a plot of land or a section of land, and they subdivide and they sell the land off for a profit and take the profit and pay down the debt on the house at the front, which they keep and renovate and rent out. And overall then, the house at the front becomes positive cash flow. It's not positive cash flow in its own right, but after the investor does something, adds value, as I said before, they end up with a positive cash flow outcome. And really, that's where the market is at the moment. Once upon a time, you could get lucky and go and buy a positive cash flow $44,000 property in Ballarat. Those days are over. Now we have to try and make that positive cash flow.
But to buy more properties, you need more debt.
Yeah, you do, until you get to a sustainable system whereby what you start doing is selling. And that's the missing link that a lot of people miss. I mean, you do a lot of business interviews. I mean, you've interviewed a lot of talent over the years. Have you ever interviewed anyone in business that didn't sell? Every business has to sell something, except in real estate, or so we're told, where you buy and never sell. But the way I've looked at real estate, I'll own an asset until such time as it makes sense to sell it. Now, it might make sense to sell it, for instance, if my return is going down over time. Consider this example. Let's say we buy a $100,000 property that has $10,000 a year in rent. And let's say that the property goes up from $100,000 to $200,000 in value, but the rent stays the same. Really what we've got, we've halved our return. But people don't think like that. They think on cost.
At what point do you decide to sell, though?
I think you decide to sell when your return can be maximised in other investments. But again, look at why people don't sell. The number one reason why someone doesn't sell a piece of real estate is because they don't want to pay tax. But again, I don't know any successful business that doesn't pay tax. It's a byproduct of wealth creation. But people live in this unreal world where they have unrealised gains on their property in the form of capital appreciation that they then try and draw down on to fund their retirement. But as I've written in the book, that's really dangerous, because if you've got an investment property and you redraw that equity to pay for lifestyle expenses, the debt is no longer deductible from a tax point of view. So you're faced in a situation in life where you've got increasing non-deductible debt that you're borrowing against your investment portfolio. How are you going to repay that debt? You're eventually going to need to sell the property. You've probably reclaimed a lot of the equity, but what are you going to pay the capital gains tax out of? It's a recipe for disaster. So all these guys out there that are touting wealth creation schemes that say, you know, buy a property and live off it in retirement, haven't actually thought through it. I don't think it's a good idea at all. As an accountant, I can tell you that it really sucks. Yeah, it sounds good, live off your nest egg in retirement, but practically it's fraught with huge danger.
So you're selling what was a good property and is a good property in order to buy another one, which you might believe is better?
Yeah, well, look at it this way. We call it multiplication by division. So we bought that $44,000 property in Ballarat back in 1999. It went up to, say, $80,000. We sold it at $80,000 and went to a different area and bought two more $40,000 properties. So we turned one into two. Then those two properties went up in value and we turned two into four. And then they went up in value and we turned four into eight. If we had have refinanced that original property rather than selling it, then our debt would have increased, which would have placed us in greater risk. Also, we would only have been able to borrow maybe up to 80% of the value of the equity. And then really, and this is the kicker, when it comes time to borrowing more money, what do lenders use? They use the tax return. So if you've got your profits flushing through to your tax return, then that allows you to go and buy more real estate. But if it never touches your tax return, the bank won't use it. So by selling, it was the missing piece of the jigsaw puzzle, if you like, that allowed us to go and buy more and more and more real estate, because we're still only borrowing 80%. But because we had more and more and more income coming through to our tax return in the form of capital gains, it allowed us to service that debt and to prove that we could handle it.
But the $40,000 property you bought that's gone up to $80,000, if you then want to get back into the market again, presumably that $40,000 has also gone up to $80,000 somewhere else.
Which is why when we started in Ballarat and then went to the Latrobe Valley, then we went to Tassie, then we went commercial, then we went New Zealand and the estates and then came back. So it's about understanding the strategy. What I would say, though, is most people own one or two properties, but I think that's a bit dangerous in its own right because you've got a lack of diversification across your property. What I would rather do is instead of own, say, one Toorak property, I'd rather own 10 regional properties because it diversifies my risk, which is the way that I like to invest. So really, I'm a big advocate on selling. I'm a big advocate because it realises that gain. And a lot of people thought they made money when the values went up, but they don't think they've lost value when it goes down again. And it's flawed thinking. But if you can realise that gain and lock yourself out of the market, I'm not talking about spending that money on lifestyle. I'm talking about using that investment profit you've made to go and buy more real estate or to repay debt to improve your cash flow.
But the way you're describing it, you become a property trader.
Yeah, that's the risk, isn't it? And certainly from a tax point of view, you get the capital gains tax discount of 50% if you're an investor, but you don't get that if you're a property trader, because you've got trading stock rather than an investment, if you like. So what you've got to do is be very careful. What I'd say, generally speaking, is that people ought to go and get some professional accounting advice about the way that they do their investments.
We've been talking a lot about debt. You say there's a bad debt or a worse debt.
Yeah, Michael, it's so common that you hear in wealth creation circles the difference between good debt and bad debt. Good debt being something that someone else repays on your behalf. If you've got a tenant repaying the property, well, that's good debt. The tenant's paying the loan for you. And then there's bad debt, which is debt that you have to pay yourself, you know, your personal credit cards and that kind of thing. Personally, I think it's a pile of hogwash. I think there's only one kind of debt, and that's bad debt. Because my grandfather used to say that the only people who ever went broke were those that owed money. So if we could engineer a situation where we had a whole lot of wealth and not a whole lot of debt, then that's a pretty safe position, particularly in retirement. The way that I view debt, it's really like a double-edged sword. It's necessary, but it's something that we ought to try and manage carefully and eventually get out of to safeguard our own property portfolio and our own investment nest eggs. We talk about when interest rates are at 17%, and people say, oh, Steve, interest rates would never return to 17% again, would they? They forget that the overdraft rate at the same time was 25%. And the interest rates have come off their lows of 5 and 6%, and we have a generation of people that never really knew what it's like to try and invest in a high interest rate, high inflation environment. People think that we have a once-in-a-100-year storm. Well, we have a once-in-a-100-year storm because once-in-a-100 years it comes along. We have interest rate cycles where interest rates fluctuate from 5% to 17%. It's reasonable to expect one day for them to go back to 17%. If we live in ignorance, then it's likely that we'll lose a lot of money. I always invest believing the worst-case scenario rather than the best-case scenario, and I always invest with one eye assuming that interest rates are going to be 12 or 13% in 2 or 3 years' time, and I have to ask myself, what does that do to my investing position? So when I talk about debt, I don't talk about good debt and bad debt. I talk about bad debt, if you like, and worse debt. And bad debt is debt for investment purposes, and worse debt is debt you've got personally. I'd certainly encourage all the listeners to have a good hard think about what's going on in their debt management. And if they're in debt, have a plan for getting out of debt as well. That's really critical.
So how do you determine how much debt you should put into the property that you're going to buy?
I think the two variables, Michael, are your skill as an investor and also what's happening in the current property market at the moment. If you don't know how to manage debt, then you shouldn't get into a lot of debt because you're just going to get into trouble. new investors perhaps ought to sit around the 70% loan-to-valuation ratio. So don't borrow more than 70 or perhaps 75%. And if the market's going down, borrow less than that. In the book, I talk about chapter 6, I think it is actually, there's a matrix that says in a flat market and you're a new investor, try and stick to between 60 and 75%. If you're a more experienced investor, then maybe go up to 70 to 85% in a flat market, then that's debt relative to the value of the property. As the market increases or hots up, maybe you want to increase those rates. But yeah, really apply that matrix in chapter 6 and try and figure out where you are at the moment relative to it. Certainly, as your experience grows, you can get into more debt. But as the market deteriorates, you should get into less debt. So it's not a one figure for every occasion. What we need to do is try and toggle or vary according to the market conditions. I don't know very many people that walk around in board shorts in the middle of winter. And I don't know many people that wear a fur coat in the middle of summer. And it's like that in investing. Most people try and put on the same investing pants and jacket every day. But as the situation changes, we need to change our approach as well, or risk an inappropriate situation.
You say we need to change our approach according to the market, but we don't know which way the market's going to go tomorrow.
No, you don't. But as an investor, it's important that you form an opinion. And this is, again, a mistake that some people make, is that they wait to see what the market does and then react to it. What I try and do is understand the market and what drives the market and form a proactive position so that as the market unfolds to what I think is going to happen next, I'm already prepared and investing in that situation. And that's really the property clock that I put out for the first time ever in this latest book.
Well, now you've got to tell us about the property clock.
There are four basic phases to a property market. The property market goes up, it goes flat, it goes down, and it goes flat, and it goes up. So up, flat, down, flat, up, flat, down, flat. Now, the clock as I've drawn in the book is probably a little misrepresentative because it shows that each period is roughly equal. And as I've said earlier, the property market tends to go up for about a third of the time and is flat or down for about two-thirds of the time. So while the clock looks pretty, it's not entirely correct in the way that it's drawn. But really what we need to do is we need to make an opinion as to what the market's going to do next and change our investing strategy before it happens. Now, that introduces the chance that we might be wrong, but there's no certainty in investing. But one thing is for sure is that if you don't change your investing strategy but the market changes, then you're in an increased likelihood of losing money or not maximizing your return. Let's look at it as an example. We went through a boom period and we never knew when the boom was going to end. And some people were second-guessing when the boom was going to end. So they're wondering, well, when do I sell? Do I try and sell now? And, you know, is now the top of the market? Mm. But, of course, you'll never ever know the top of the market until the top of the market's come and gone, because it takes months for statistics to be collated and then reported. So when it comes time to selling then, you don't sell your property trying to guess when the top of the market is. You wait for the next flat period after the top of the market to then judge at the time is right to sell.
The alarm bell doesn't go off on your clock, does it?
No, unfortunately. I wish it did. It might be a wake-up call. But let's look at that. So we have an upturn, we have a boom generally, and then we have a flat period. As this next flat period comes in, and we saw this in the Eastern Seaboard probably around the end of 2004, coming into 2005, what we need to do is start reducing debt. And that's our signal to start selling some marginal deals. A lot of people own real estate in the boom that didn't perform particularly well. But if it didn't perform particularly well during the boom, how much worse is it going to perform during a flat time? So that's why in the clock I start talking about needing to sell marginal deals, because these marginal deals are probably going to become a weight that's going to drag you down in a softer market. So as the market comes off the peak, reduce debt, sell marginal deals, get a handle on how you're managing your money. That's the message. But sometimes a market that goes flat will drift downwards because there's panic that gets introduced. A couple of high-profile people go under, get prosecuted through the courts, get sent to jail, banks start collapsing. These kind of things all destabilize and cause the market to be uncertain. So during a downturn, the name of the game is survival. And those people that aren't prepared in that survival phase tend to go under. And I mean, I was working in my first job as an accountant in the early 1990s, and I had clients receiving phone calls from banks saying, ring, 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 g'day, it's Bob from the ABC Bank. We need you to pay back $50,000 by the end of this week or we're foreclosing. Well, these people didn't have $50,000 and the bank foreclosed. Mm. And it's about survival, so you're going to need more cash in a downturn. And that's why you should be reducing your debt, so that you're A, below the bank's radar screen about risk factor, and B, you're going to need cash to buy great deals as and when they come up. But of course, a downturn doesn't last forever. Eventually, people go, well, now's a good time to buy. And so then you get another flat period. Then after that flat period, speculators start coming back to the market and prices start going up. Property market's a lot like the Titanic. Not that it's eventually going to sink, or maybe it will, but it just takes so long for it to change direction. It's not like the stock market that can go up and down 5% in a day. The property market doesn't do that. You need to understand the beast that you're investing in. But here's an idea out of left field, if you like. Let's say that you're a long-term investor, and you're saying that, look, the property market's flat. I know my property's not going to do anything for 5 years. Why would you hold the investment? You're going to be out of the money for 5 years.
So what do you do?
Well, I reckon you sell. And it's controversial, again, because then you've got to pay the tax. But see, investors don't buy and hold forever. They always try and maximise their money. So if there's a better opportunity elsewhere, if there's not, then you hold. But if there's a better opportunity elsewhere, or you want to reduce your risk, then you sell. And that's why, towards the end of 2004 and 2005, I think we sold 75% of our portfolio and just sat on a big pile of cash. And then once everyone else felt the pain and started to sell, we started to buy back in. Because it's the old adage that, you know, buy straw hats in the winter when no one wants straw hats and they're cheap. So you want to sell prior to everyone else realizing that they have to sell, and you want to buy when everyone else is selling. Again, it's business principles applied in a real estate context. Oh, that's great, but what about someone who now hasn't sold and is stuck in the mud effectively? Well, unfortunately, I don't have a quick fix for you other than saying that all my properties are for sale. They don't all have boards out the front of them saying they're for sale. But I say to the real estate agents that I deal with, if you can find a buyer for the property who's willing to pay a good price, then I'll sell. Because you're not going to sell something that's not for sale. So you don't have to formally list it, but you at least need to have that conversation.
So what do you do, broad brush, in a weak market?
First of all, I'd sell. I know that sounds a little bit strange, but I wouldn't sell everything. I'd just sell the deals on the fringe, the marginal ones, the ones that haven't been particularly profitable. And then what I would do, or what selling does, is it repays debt. So it helps you in from a risk point of view and allows you to then borrow more potentially later on. I had a story that I talked about in the book about Vanessa, and what happened with Vanessa, a Sydney investor, was she owned a lot of growth property. And the Sydney market started to turn, and I saw the writing on the wall, and I said, well, you know, maybe you should be thinking about selling some of this marginal property, which she did, and she locked out the debt. So she repaid the debt. It took her overall debt lower, took her cash flow up because she had less debt overall on her portfolio. And luckily, in that situation, the market did come down, and so she sold the property for about $50,000 more than what it'd be worth today. Now, sometimes a dollar saved is a dollar made, and although she hasn't made $50,000 in profit in her pocket, she's effectively saved $50,000, which is kind of the same thing. So the first thing I'd say is, you know, really consider and think hard about selling marginal deals. The second thing I'd say is reduce debt. And one of the reasons why you want to reduce debt is that ability to then buy back later, because a lot of people are maxed out at the moment. If they go to the bank says, look, we're not going to lend you anymore. Well, what good's that if you find a great deal? You're not going to be able to capitalise on it. So you need to be a bit clever about the way you do things. The next thing I'd say is you need to set benchmarks with your investing. A lot of people buy and hold and hope for profit. But just as any good business will have a budget, any good investor needs an investing budget as well that actually clarifies and quantifies the amount of the return they expect from their investment. If it meets the target, great. If it doesn't, then maybe that's a red flag that you need to be more proactive about the way that you manage your real estate, or alternatively, that it's time to sell. Earlier you said to me, Steve, how do you know when you should sell a piece of real estate? Well, a lot of people don't know because they never set that profit benchmark. But on all my properties that I own, I have, like, this property, 123 Smith Street, needs to increase by $30,000 this year. So I'll then go and get a valuation at the end of the year. And if it hasn't increased by $30,000, I'll look at it and either say, well, what do I need to do to increase the value? Or alternatively, if it's come time, the season's ended, the fruit's dropped off the tree, well, sell the tree. Start again somewhere else. Buy another tree.
But you've got to find that other tree.
Yeah, it's not that hard when you know what to look for. I know that sounds a bit flippant. Really, a lot of people buy solutions. You walk into a real estate agent's office and they've got the feature property and they've got the glossy brochure. I don't buy any of that because really the money's already been made on that deal. Consider it this way. Let's say off the plan apartment, pretty topical. A lot of people bought off the plan apartments. A lot of people didn't make much money. Well, what really happened? Well, the developer made money because he or she took a problem block of land and turned it into a solution, off the plan apartments. But the investor won't make any money until that off the plan apartment goes up in value. So I call that an automatic profit. The whole market has to go up in order for that to be profitable. I don't like those deals because there's not much I can do to add value to get an above market return. So I wouldn't buy that kind of deal because it's a solution. I wouldn't buy a pre-renovated house. I'd buy a house that needs renovating because that's the value add opportunity. So the question about how do you go and find deals that are likely to make money, I say the bigger the problem, the more money you can make. Also, the bigger the chance for a loss. So you need to know that you only want to buy problems that you can solve and fix. But everyone gets paid to solve a problem. The guy working in the coffee shop gets paid to wait tables and to pour coffees. The news agent gets paid to sell magazines to solve people's information problems. In real estate, investors get paid to solve investing problems. If you want to be an investor but don't want to solve problems, then the only way you're going to make money is if the whole market goes up. And as I said, that only happens about a third of the time. We need to change the whole way we think about investing to become far more proactive.
Do you renovate many of your properties?
None. I know this is an audio recording, but you can look at my hands and know that these hands tend to hold a pen rather than a hammer. But what I'd say is...
But to employ people to do it.
Exactly. And that's what investing is. Investing isn't about you doing the work. Investing is about applying a system and then out of the profit that you make on the deal, paying other people to do the work. A lot of do-it-yourself investors out there that do home renovations, well, that's not investing. That's just getting paid money for labour. They do the work, they get paid the money. I don't have the time or the inclination to paint or pull up nails out of the floor or sand floors or anything else like that. I even hate gardening. But what I do like doing is thinking and being proactive about the way that I solve problems. That's my greatest skill. It's not choosing a colour. I'll pay an interior designer to do that. But it's working out a way of buying 10 properties and getting a team of 10 people, the carpenter, a painter, a landscaper, whatever, and do 10 at once. That way I'll get economies of scale, which allows me to then get wholesale rates rather than retail rates on the work that I do.
You've sold a property that isn't doing all that well. Mm-hmm. You go into the marketplace to try and buy another one or two. You've got to either go interstate or find a cheaper suburb or whatever. Or do you go then looking for properties that you can do something with?
Yeah, and that comes back to the whole idea of cash versus cash flow. If you want to make a quick 20 or 30 grand, you don't need to look very far. The house next door, the house across the road, anywhere where there's a problem where you live. If you want a cash flow asset and you just want to go and buy it, remember, problems and solutions. A lot of people want to go and buy a positive cash flow solution, a house that is already positive cash flow without them having to do anything. And these days, where they exist is outlying regional areas. And even then, they're a little bit hard to find. The new way of thinking that we have to apply is to go and skill up to be able to solve problems and then perhaps get into a few cash deals to form a bank and then go and buy another property and then pay down the debt in order for it to be cash flow. So we have to start doing a 2 or 3 or a 4-step process to end up with a cash flow outcome rather than just going out there and trying to buy a positive cash flow solution property. So things have changed.
But you have to spend all your life doing that, basically, like you are.
Yeah, well, you would think so, until, again, you have to start doing things a bit smarter than the average bear. And the way that I did it is I train real estate agents with my system to get them to look for the properties on my behalf, rather than me. I don't spend my weekends out there looking for property. I work hard to have a network with real estate agents so that when they find a deal, they ring me before it even hits the market. A lot of people wonder, what's the best day of the week to go and buy property? And I think the worst day of the week is a Saturday, because that's when everyone else is out there buying a property. My preferred time of the week to go and buy real estate is 11 o'clock on a Monday morning, because everyone else is at work normally, and all the properties that didn't sell on the weekend now have vendors saying, man, I hope someone's going to come along. And I ring up and I say, hi, Michael, the real estate agent. Hey, what do you got for me? Oh, this didn't move on the weekend. The vendors are a bit keener to sell. They're a bit more negotiable on price. It's about thinking differently and thinking smarter and not doing what everyone else is doing, and that's what creates the opportunity. I had a real estate agent ring me a while back, and I talk about the billboard deal in the book. The real estate agent rang me up and said, Steve, there's a billboard going for sale, and it's $117,500, and the rent on it is $11,500. Quick maths in my head, thought, wow, that sounds like a pretty good return, particularly when you consider that the $11,500 is plus GST and the $117,500 is including GST. So if you buy it through a GST-registered entity, you get 1/11 of it back. So it turns out to be about a 10.7% return. Now, this probably didn't even hit the market. Mm. How come I got first dibs at it? Well, because I've got the relationship with the real estate agent. Now, how do you go and find and buy a positive cash flow deal? They're out there every day of the week. But what people want to do is they want the deal to come to them on their terms, and it doesn't happen like that. You need to work the market, and you need to form a reputation as someone who does something. Then the deals will find you. They really do.
Now, Steve, in Chapter 12, you mentioned 15 tips for achieving accelerated growth. Would you mind just picking out, say, 4 or so that we can get an idea of what you're talking about?
well, let's look at a common one. Let's look at this thing I call the ripple effect. Everyone knows that certain suburbs boom, and there's a tendency for people to flock to that area then and say, oh, I want to get in on the trend. You know, Smithville is becoming popular. Everyone wants to live in Smithville. I'll go and buy a property in Smithville as well. I wouldn't do that. I think if you go and do what everyone else has done, then you're just going to add to the mania. So what I'd try and do is be a little bit smart about it. I'd go and buy in the suburb next out from Smithville, because what I've found from studying real estate trends is that eventually Smithville will become too expensive for a demographic, usually first home buyers. So what people do is they make a concession. We won't live in Smithville. We'll live on the other side of the street in Smithville, in Waynesville, and they'll get perceived prestige by living nearby. And then gradually, over time, the adjacent area that hasn't moved in price because it's not yet trendy will present with the best buying opportunity. But I'd still do things a bit different again.
That could take time though, couldn't it?
Yeah, and that's where you want to be smart, because what I would do is instead of going and buying a property and just start paying interest and renting it out and potentially being negative cash flow, I'd go to someone who had a property for sale in Waynesville and I'd say, look, your property is currently for sale for $250,000. And I'd say, yeah, that's right. And I'd say, oh, I'm going to pay $275,000. What? Are you mad? It's for sale for $250,000. No, I want to give you more. I want to pay $275,000, but there's a couple of conditions. Uh-huh, what's the condition? Well, the first condition is I actually can't settle for 18 months. So you're going to continue to own the property, collect all the rent for 18 months, everything else like that. And then in 18 months' time, I'll settle. So what I'm doing is starting to become an investor and make the call of I'll pay you $25,000 more now, try and leave as low a deposit as I possibly can because that it's into my working capital. But then in 18 months' time, I'm making the call that the property is going to be worth more than $25,000 extra I'm paying for it right now. So I lock myself into the market and potentially benefit from any capital appreciation over $25,000. So then 18 months later, in an ideal situation, the property might be worth $50,000 more. Well, I'll go and get a bank valuation for 80% of the higher value, which allows me to borrow more. Or alternatively, I'll just sell the property and just make a quick $15,000 or $20,000 capital gain after costs.
That's almost gambling though, isn't it?
Well, it may seem like gambling, but the difference between gambling and investing, and sometimes the line is a little bit blurred, is the skill that you bring to the table. If you know and have researched areas and that you know and have researched valuating opportunities, then really what you're doing is you're backing your ability to find that investment. Most people gamble when it comes to real estate investing, or what they think is real estate investing, because they buy, hold and hope. They might as well go to the local casino and buy, hold and hope playing roulette or blackjack. But the way that I invest, and again, after starting in 1999 and buying so much real estate, I think I've got the system and the skill to be able to pull this off. That's why I've written this book, to share more insights to people about how to skill up so that they can achieve a similar return.
More examples?
Perhaps another one, Michael, is make sure you stand in the shoes of the next person buying your property. A lot of people sell real estate, and what they do is they go to a real estate agent and say, please sell me my property. But what they fail to do is really try and work out who's going to buy it. If you have a business, then what you want to try and do is identify your target market. And by identifying your target market, you can look at ways in order to try and get them to pay more money for what you've got. For instance, then in real estate, a target market might be you might own a property that is suited to, say, a family. It's got a cubby house out the back and that kind of thing. Well, you say, well, the person that's likely to buy this house is a family. What can I do to this house to make it more appealing for that next family? And as you start to think in that term, instead of worrying about what you can get out of the property, what you can contribute to someone else's enjoyment helps you to position the property so A, it sells quicker and B, it sells for more. Some people I know own investment property that would only ever be purchased by another investor. It's not suitable for a home. It's a cheaper house in a cheaper area that's what I call a transition property. For those guys, I'd say, well, how can you sell the property and make it attractive for an investor? Perhaps they can leave some money in the deal. Perhaps they can offer a low deposit. Perhaps they can offer a longer settlement. But in return, they get a higher price. So it's the way that you vary your price or your terms to make it more attractive as a housing product for the next buyer. Again, most people can only think about themselves. What's in it for me? How much money can I make? How can I sell it quickly? But if you change your focus to be, instead of being me, being, well, how can I help the next purchaser make better use of the property? Then by solving that problem, you'll create and make money. And that's what I've done time and time again. A third tip is just look at housing shortages. Generally speaking, if you've got more demand than supply, prices are going to go up. In that case, you'll usually find that properties that are for rent in areas where there aren't a lot of properties for rent push rents up as well. So what I try and do is look for areas where there is just a shortage of housing. And you can find that out reasonably quickly in terms of how popular an area is by looking at auction clearance rates and median house price movements and that kind of thing. I also like areas that have increased infrastructure. In Melbourne, for instance, we've got that Connect East project that's going to open up the eastern, southeastern corridor. It's going to be a tollway, but people have cars. They're going to want to save time. They're going to drive on it. So what I would say, this probably brings in the ripple effect and also this shortage, is I wouldn't buy in the area where the freeway is going to go through, because that's already moved. I'd buy the suburb or two suburbs away on a longer term settlement. And then what I'd also do is look for some kind of shortage of housing in that area. Generally speaking, units, I'm not a big fan of units because there's lots of units. I like four-bedroom houses because it's slightly bigger than a three-bedroom house. Therefore, it's just in a bit of shortage. People pay for houses not on the land size, not on the number of living rooms or dining rooms or kitchens or bathrooms, but on the number of bedrooms. So if I can buy a four-bedroom house where most of the other houses are three-bedroom, simply buying a house with that shortage will mean that my property will always outperform the market, those other three-bedroom houses. So, it's about being smart with the way you apply your strategy.
But obviously you pay more in the first place for that.
Well, you would think you would, but then it comes down to a matter of trying to find a house, a four-bedroom house, that might be a problem house. For instance, you might buy a three-bedroom house with two living areas and then convert one of those living areas into a fourth bedroom. And all of a sudden you've bought at a three-bedroom price, but you've turned it into a four-bedroom, and by turning it into a four-bedroom house, you're competing in a completely different market. Again, instead of trying to buy something and wait for it to go up, what you tend to do is you buy a piece of real estate and you apply a strategy to it to automate or to leverage your position in terms of you're adding value to make a profit.
You talked about trying to get the rent higher. How do you do that?
You ask. I know it sounds strange, but a lot of people expect the tenant to come to them and expect, hello, I'm here to tell you that I'm here to pay more rent. And I don't think that's ever happened to me. But I've certainly gone to a tenant many times and said, well, look, how can I increase your enjoyment of this property? If you were the owner, what would you have done? What would you fix? And they'll say, oh, it's a bit cold in the bathroom. And I'll say, well, maybe what we could do is put in a heat lamp in the bathroom. And they say, yeah, that'd be great. And you'd say, well, I'll go and work out the cost of that. And it comes back and I don't do it. I'd electrocute myself if I even tried. I'm not interested in that. I'd go and get an electrician to give me a quote. And let's say the quote comes back at $300. And I'd give them the quote and I'd say, look, you know, it costs $300. What do you propose to do? And they'd say, oh, well, I guess we could pay some more rent. And you'd say, well, how much more rent are you thinking about paying? And they might say, well, we can only really afford $5 a week. And I'd say, well, $5 a week, that's $260 a year. The cost of it's $300. You probably wouldn't do it because you don't get a payback in the first year. Except what people don't understand is that that increased rent not only increases your cash flow, but it also makes your property worth more. If you've got two identical houses side by side and one earns $200 extra rent, which one will the investor pay more money for? The one with the higher rent. So that there's actually two factors to a rental increase. There's the extra cash flow you get and then the increased value your property's worth. And I call that the rental multiplier effect. So ultimately what you've got is a situation, if you like, where for $5 a week, $260 a year, it's only going to cost you $300. Well, what happens the second year? Well, you've basically got profit. Who in their right mind wouldn't invest $300 to get a huge return? It's a good use of the money. So the first thing, Michael, I'd say is you have to ask. And then in asking, listen. Ask them what they want and listen to it and then try and cost it and provide it. Another way of doing it is to value add again. Is a lot of tenants, for instance, in a demographic student accommodation will pay more for a furnished apartment. Does that mean you need to go to your local homemaker centre and buy expensive furniture? No, you'd be crazy to do that because the students, they're going to trash it, right? What you do is you go to eBay and you try and find some cheap furniture made in China that is durable and say to them, look, the cost to rent the unit or the house is $300 a week. Or alternatively, I can give it to you furnished for $350 a week and you just do the sums and know that you're going to make more money. Another strategy is to rent it by the room rather than by the house. If you go to the coffee shop or the cake shop and buy a piece of cake by the slice, you're always going to pay more than buying the whole cake yourself. Well, you can do the same in real estate. If you've got a three-bedroom house, instead of renting it once, you can rent it three times, one bedroom to three people. Now, that might be some more increased management. Do I do the management? No. So I pay someone to do the management. So I might have to pay a percent or two higher in terms of a rental management fee. But that's all covered out of the additional rent anyway. Again, think differently. Reward your tenant. And this is one of the ways that I avoid vacancies. when the tenant pays the rent on time, I'll give them an incentive. I'll give them a thank you. Here's a couple of movie tickets. Here's a dinner out. Like, I'll reward the tenant for doing the right thing. Because the way that most landlords do it is they hit them with the big stick when they do the wrong thing. They take them to the tribunal. Or we all know with kids, like, I've two small kids at home, if I tell them what not to do, they do it. If I reward them for doing the right thing, then they're more inclined to do it. It's the same with tenants. You want to train your tenant to do the right thing by giving them rewards for doing the right thing, not penalties for doing the wrong thing.
When you say you talk to the tenant, do you mean that literally, or do you get an agent to do that?
Sometimes through an agent, but most often I try and talk to them and form a relationship with them as well. I rented for a long time, and I used to get so frustrated with the inability of real estate agents and real estate managers. Being a rental manager is the worst job in the world, and there's a lot of turnover. So what I try and do is form the relationship with the tenant so that they know that if they've got a problem, they go via the real estate agent, but they know they'll always get to me. I always give them my mobile phone number so that in an event of emergency and they can't get the rental manager, they know they can get me, because it's about building a relationship. Does that mean if the toilet blocks in the middle of the night, I get out there with a plunger? No, I call the plumber. But people feel like there's a relationship and therefore they'll stay longer.
Do you call the plumber or an agent calls the plumber?
Ordinarily, the agent will call the plumber, but if the tenant can't get the agent and they call me on the mobile, oh, Steve, there's a tragedy, something's happened, the toy got flushed down the toilet, I'll call the plumber and get the plumber to call them and step in so that they feel like they got good service.
But you do get an agent to collect the money on a regular
basis. Yeah. Now, the less I do, the happier I am, as a general rule. So I'm willing to pay someone else and outsource it for a share of the profit in the deal.
Steve, we've covered a lot of territory in the last little while. Why did you actually write the book?
Not for fun. I enjoyed writing the book, but I'll share with the listeners a little bit about writing a book. I actually locked myself away for 6 weeks. Really, the first book was all about me, and talking about myself is my least favourite topic. The second book was all about the people that I mentored, and the third book is really all about trying to give the average reader far more information about how they can use strategy and investing skill to increase their market return or their real estate profits. And I've written it because I can see the real estate market changing, and I have this fear that people, the way they've managed their debt and the way they've done their investing is going to come back and bite them badly. So there's still hope. We're not in a crisis just yet. We may end up in a crisis if interest rates keep going up, but we have a window of opportunity if we're proactive to do something about it. Really, from a financial point of view, I know this, again, may sound a bit cliche, like that's not my motive in writing the book. My motive in writing the book is really to try and give the reader far more information than they really think the book's even worth. But my hope is to get emails, as I get from time to time, from people who've read my other books saying it's really had a positive impact in their lives. And that makes me feel good about myself. That's part of the reason why I feel like I've got something to contribute back to society.
You have an organisation called Property Investing, mm-hmm. but you don't actually ask for money from other people to invest.
No, I don't. Again, I kind of wince as I say this. All the royalties from the book actually go to a foundation that I set up. I actually run three businesses. I have the investing I do on my own behalf. I have propertyinvesting.com, and I have this foundation that I set up. And I have a vision for the foundation, and I'm really the only one who contributes to the foundation. And in order to make that vision a reality, I need money, because that's what you do with a foundation. You put money in it. So writing this book is what I see, Michael, as a win-win outcome. I share information with people to help them with their investing, and they share money with me, which I then share with other people. That's the way I like to do investing. I personally think I've probably got enough money. You buy 260 properties over a number of years, you make a lot of money. I do it because I just like to share the information, and I see it as a win-win-win outcome. So it works.
Do you offer your services one-to-one?
No. I'd stopped selling my time when I was an accountant. I don't like doing that. I see that as a poor return on time invested. I'd never have to buy a lunch again, ever, if I went out to lunch with everyone who asked me to go out for lunch. I feel my greatest benefit and where I can leverage what I know is by writing a book, because then, you know, 100,000 people can buy the book and benefit from it. 140,000 people bought my first book. Like, that's amazing. Like, if you try and figure out that two people probably read each copy of the book on average, and you can fill the MCG a few times over.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, that's a nice feeling to know that you've had an impact in people's lives.
But if people have questions, they can ask you, or you conduct seminars for that purpose.
Yeah, I do run what I would regard as occasional seminars. Again, I'm pretty protective about my time because I've got two young kids, and I'm at the other end of the extreme. I'm at the financial freedom end, really. Like, I don't need to do this. I do it because I do it on my terms and in a way that I'm happy to do it. So I run seminars when I feel like I want to run seminars and I can help people. if people have questions, really the best place to go is the free website, propertyinvesting.com, where I run free forums where people can post questions and other investors, and if time permits, I can jump on and help them answer that question. People often ask me, where's the angle, Steve? Everyone's in it for an angle. Where's your angle? And I say, well, I don't know. I've got an office. It's got overhead. I need to cover that overhead. Therefore, I run occasional seminars to do it. But I actually just love sharing information. Again, it's cliche and all the rest of it, but that's the truth.
How old are you, Steve?
34.
And you're going to keep doing this?
No, is the answer. I reckon I'm going to keep going until the foundation meets its income mark. And it's no secret, it's $5 million I'm trying to pour into the foundation. Once the foundation gets to $5 million, you know, I'll get on my horse and ride off into the sunset. One of the things that I really like the idea of is in 10 years' time for people to see the book on the shelf and go, Steve McKnight, what happened to Steve McKnight? Well, Steve McKnight was a success, like he said he was, and no longer was doing what he did because he wanted to go and do other things. I think I'd like to learn to play guitar.
Well, that's a pretty good note to finish on.
It is, except that I'd just like to thank people again for buying the book, for trusting me enough to pick up a copy. If they liked the book, then I'd encourage them just to tell their friends what they got out of it, because that'll share the information. And whatever they do, don't hoard the knowledge. Like, I've written this book to educate people. I would invite the readers to then try and educate their friends and family about the principles in the book. I'm okay if you give them the book to read. Maybe, ideally, you'd buy them a copy as well as a present. But if not, if you're tight for money, then share it around, because the more people we help and the more we can get this information out there, the more lives we can impact. And that's really what I'm all about.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Michael.
And that brings us to the end of this interview. I trust you've benefited from the information that Steve McKnight has shared, and I hope that you enjoy reading the book, From Naught to 260 Plus Properties in 7 Years. The book, of course, is published by Wright Books, and this interview has been recorded by Business Essentials Proprietary Limited. I'm Michael Schulberger. Thanks for listening.